I think that's the key word, play. It does feel like I didn't give myself time to play a year ago. And now that Emmy's here and we are playing constantly every single day, it kind of turned on this other part of my brain that made me want to play a bit more professionally, a bit more grown up. And I think that's where a lot of this work came from.
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today, I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with Tanner Woodford. Tanner is founder and executive director of the Design Museum of Chicago. He's produced over 35 exhibitions over the last 10 years. Tanner is an independent artist and teaches at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. As a designer, educator, and entrepreneur, Tanner's taught, lectured, and led workshops on design issues, social change, and design history in both classrooms and at conferences. Tanner is dad to his one-year-old daughter. In this episode, Tanner explains how he left his corporate job at Morningstar to found what would become Chicago's first ever pop-up design museum. We talk about the value of escape, his myriad father figures, both painful and positive, and the amazing creative energy he gets from his daughter.
I'd love to start things with a sense for your own upbringing, early influences, particularly around your relationship with your dad. And maybe to start, just how'd you characterize your relationship with your dad, Tanner?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I had a really wonderful childhood. I mean, a lot happened, you know. I had a lot of father figures, some better than others. My parents got a divorce when I was fairly young, so I split my time between my mom's place in a small town called Macomb, Illinois, about 200 miles south of Chicago, and a farm at my dad's place just outside of Macomb. So I'd be on the farm on the weekends, and I'd be in town on the weekdays. And it provided this sort of really nice contrast, you know, of being able to go and to just sort of do the outdoorsy farm stuff, and then kind of being back in town and being a little more active or playing on the computer or like kind of exploring some of my personal passions. So growing up with my dad, you know, I wasn't with him every day, but when I was with him, it was sort of very active. You know, we were doing a lot. I was learning a lot. He always had the mindset that he would provide anything for me as long as it was educational. So, you know, growing up, he sent me to Costa Rica for a week when I was a freshman in high school. So it was this sort of moment of intense exploration in a country I'd never been to. And, you know, that was precisely because my father believed that it was important to provide me opportunities, even if they were a step up from where I was. I also had some stepfathers who I had a pretty rocky relationship with.
Out of those different men who played similar roles in terms of father figure, whether they were, you know, conducive to your growth and upbringing and this idea of exposure and creating opportunities or not, did they have an influence on early creative pursuits? Like what's your origin story in terms of discovering art or design, and were they any part of that?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of really important moments when I was growing up and discovering creativity and art and design. And one of them was when I was 16 years old. I went with my dad and my stepmom to the Salvador Dali Museum. And that was such a life-changing experience for me, being able to take a tour and seeing a bunch of his masterworks and also some of his sketches and his lobster phone, and then sort of taking that energy and going straight out to the beach and taking a bunch of photographs. This was right around the time that we were starting to talk about college more seriously. So we were planning trips up to Chicago to the School of the Art Institute, out to Arizona State University, where I ended up going. And it was this really exciting time where there was a lot of freedom. There was a big sense of exploration. Another time that was really sort of exciting and definitive and defining for me was going actually through 4-H as a kid. You work all year toward like planning and raising cattle and doing all of these farm activities. But when we started to really kind of get into 4-H as a family, you know, my brother would always take care of the animals and do the farming stuff. And then I found myself building things with my grandpa, doing woodworking, building shelves and birdhouses and those sorts of things, and then actually doing fabric art, so doing some kind of like early fashion and going inside of the barns and displaying work, and then competing for awards and things in that way. So as everybody else was sort of exploring things on the farm, I was exploring things in the house. And that led to more painting and creativity and that sort of thing.
I associate art and design with big cities, or at least that kind of environment where you have a lot of different cultures coming together. And I feel like it's easy to write off a place like Macomb, Illinois, or growing up on a farm or doing these kinds of activities as like unrelated to art or making, or and that's interesting that for you that was some of the beginnings of it.
Yeah, a really clear example. Early on, I got a book that had a whole bunch of trick photography in it, and I got super interested and excited about the idea of sort of manipulating the way somebody sees a photograph. We got a disposable camera and went to one of my, I think it was my grandfather's property or something, and took a photograph of my dad in the foreground and my stepmom like a mile away in the background. She was just a speck. My dad held out his hand like he was holding her in his hand. It was a moment of me seeing the world very differently, creating an understanding that I could manipulate the way people feel about things or see things or experience things. And there is something about having all of this space, you know, to run, to be free, to drive four-wheelers, to make messes, to really kind of explore what life could be, that I don't know if I would have gotten that freedom had I lived someplace else. I mean, I would have gotten it in a different way, I'm sure, but it was important for me.
So when you're making these decisions and you're planning to head off to Arizona State, did your dad understand this interest, this passion? How did he react or relate to you going down a pointedly artistic path?
If I could sum it up in two words, it would be nervous support. You know, he was there for me. He was interested, had a lot of questions, but also didn't really get it. You know, wasn't really interested in me going to Arizona. It was too far away. Kind of wanted me to stay close to home. I was accepted to two schools in Illinois, WIU, Western Illinois University, which is in Macomb, and the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, where I'm teaching now. But I was really interested in his nervous support, but also kind of wanting to forge my own path. I was the middle child, so I always felt like I was, you know, Kent's son or KT's brother. I never felt like I was my own person. And I felt like getting out to Arizona and being in a place where I didn't really know anybody would give me that opportunity.
Did that nervous support evolve, change?
I was going to say some of the nerves went away, but as soon as I was about to say that, I realized that's totally not true. He's a very nervous person. the support has certainly stayed and been persistent. He's always told me that he will do anything for me as long as it's educational. He's really, I know I said that, but he really believes that. Now that energy has turned toward my kid, which is really exciting. So when she was born, he started a education fund for her. We had a couple hundred dollars in there, but once a quarter or so, he'll put in money and call us and say, you know, hey, we're putting this in. We were going to give her a birthday gift. Instead, we're going to send something small and then put a bunch of money in her account. And, you know, the support certainly is still there.
That's awesome. It's cool to see it kind of migrate generationally.
Yeah.
You know, obviously he feels like you're doing right enough on your own that he can shift his attention towards your kid.
Yeah.
So you wrap up at school with a graphic design degree.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make your way back to Chicago, and what starts to happen?
Yeah, so there's one thing I want to go back to, and this I'm kind of saying a lot of this awkwardly because there's an elephant in the room I'm avoiding a little bit.
Sure.
And that's that I did have quite a few men in my life that were abusive when I was a kid. I've kind of been dancing around it a little bit, but I do think it's important to my history, and I don't know if you can, I'm nervous talking about this. I don't know if you can can hear that in the mic.
Yeah, no. Take your time, and if you start talking about it, you're like, you know what? I actually don't want to talk about it. It's all good, man. However you want to approach it, and if you want to leave it out entirely, it's 100% your choice.
Okay, cool. So mom and dad got divorced when I was like two, more or less. So I never really knew them together. I always knew them apart from my earliest memories. And my mom, who's passed now, was kind of exploring finding other people. She remarried twice. My first stepdad was a pretty terrible person, to be entirely honest with you. He was abusive to the entire family. And my mom didn't realize that when they were dating. In fact, didn't realize it until the wedding. My brother and I were disinvited from the wedding a few days beforehand. And then she learned all sorts of things about his past. He was a pretty bad dude. So I've got some pretty early memories of kind of this contrast. At this point, my dad was a very good dude. He went to church 4 or 5 nights a week, and I've only known him to be super kind and supportive. But my mom was exploring and finding other people and trying to build a new family and was really making some bad decisions, which I think she realized in retrospect, clearly, but not in the moment. So we lived with this one man for a couple of years. And like I said, he was really nasty. So I've got some memories of being in the yard and picking up rocks and picking up sticks and doing some manual labor type stuff. He trained police dogs for a living. And one of the police dogs got loose. It was one of the meanest dogs in the state. The dog ran up to me, grabbed my arm, bit me, and tried to run away. My stepdad came out, yelled at the dog, put it away, didn't want to take me to the emergency room. He didn't want to get in any trouble. So he went to the bathroom and wrapped me up. And that was that. And then I got in trouble for this happening to me. So I have a lot of memories. You know, I'm kind of dancing around a few things here, of physical and mental abuse, emotional abuse, that were very directly correlated with my dad, who at that point, when I was 8 years old or whatever, wanted to really push me toward education and safety and, you know, was really concerned with these things that were happening. So we ended up leaving that situation in the middle of the night, went to my grandpa's house, stayed there for about a week until we could get back on our feet. My mom bought a farmhouse outside of Macomb, and we stayed there, just the three of us, her, me, and my brother, for a few years. She dated some other guys who were equally terrible before finding my stepfather, my current stepfather, when I was probably, 14 or 15, I can't remember exactly. And he is one of the best guys I've ever met. He was a state trooper at the time, and he was very similar to my father in some ways, but was also a incredible supportive. Before he married mom, he asked our permission. I'll never forget. It was during the Super Bowl halftime show. She ran to the restroom, and he put it on mute and talked to my brother and I and said, you know, I want to join your family, but I'm not going to do it without your permission. And kind of went through this big speech. We gave him permission, and he proposed a few days later.
Wow.
She passed 6 years ago or so, and he was by her side the entire time. And I still talk to him almost every day. I send him, and my father, I send them pictures of my kid, and we just kind of catch up. But really went through this rocky period in my youth that defined the way that I see the world as well, learning how to deal with that aggression. I think that contrast is something that has been pretty formative for me.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that and trusting me to tell me.
Yeah.
I think it's important context for sure. And I think it's important for other people to hear, because these are hard things and not something that comes up when you're talking about your art or your work or the latest thing that's happening. And, you know, so yeah, thanks for calling an audible and going back to it and making sure that you said it. And I appreciate that. And I know that there will be other people who hear it and that resonates with them.
For sure. Yeah. Thanks for the space. Oddly enough, I'm much less nervous now than I was 2 minutes ago.
Yeah.
I felt like I got it out and needed to.
I'm glad that you got it out, because it's probably going to change your demeanor for the rest of the conversation. And that's really interesting to finally, after a childhood of pain, to end up with two dads that are equally supportive of you. And was this around the time that you were going to college or heading off to college?
I had a dad and a stepdad that were both incredible and supportive from 14 or 15 on. So really at a time when I was coming up and learning about the world And certainly when I was in college, they both checked on me often. And when I came home, I'd visit both of them. And they both, they're incredibly different people, aside from the fact that they love me and my family unconditionally. And they're very supportive of everything that we do. So I went to Arizona. I was in the game design department. I'm not even sure. I was in the art school for a year and spent that time knowing that I wasn't going to be a game designer. So really exploring 2D classes and 3D classes, photography and painting and drawing, and understanding the creative side, getting to explore the creative side of my brain. Ended up in the design school. And the design school there is extremely rigorous. There are 200 students freshman year or first year, and they whittle it down to about 50 by senior year. Got through all of that, started exploring a lot of things on the side. It was part of the founding of a conference called Phoenix Design Week when I was an undergrad. Stepped away from Phoenix Design Week and eventually worked for the school, taught in the school after I graduated. Came back to Chicago because my mother was diagnosed with colon cancer. Didn't want to go back to Macomb, but wanted to be close enough that I could come and see her. Applied for a bunch of jobs in St. Louis and Chicago. Got a gig at Morningstar doing interaction design. Was on some boards and some committees through AIGA and a bunch of local organizations. And ended up finding the Design Museum.
So you said you ended up finding the Design Museum.
Yeah.
Did you? I thought you founded it. I thought.
Oh, yeah, I did. I found it.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Got it.
It sort of feels like it was always there.
I was like, is that a play on words? Like, is that what a founder does? They find things?
Yeah. It feels like it.
It's interesting. You know, Morningstar, really, to me, it always stands out as the least likely place for design being the numbers. But then it has this rich history of holding design as a very high value as an organization and making sure that like everything from, you know, the most dry content to interactive data visualizations are all designed. And it just really stands out as a brand to me that believes in that. And to go from something that's kind of analytical and design, and you said, you know, working in interaction design and pulling from your early web design pursuits, but then making this shift from contributing to an agency as a designer to founding, you know, really a cultural institution, that's a big move. Like most people don't do that. So can you tell me a little bit about that decision, that pivot, what it was like to, you know, leave something that has a perception of security to start a museum? Like that seems like a really interesting pivot.
Yeah. And it sounds like a pivot, but it was more like a slow blend. I left Morningstar 5 years ago this week. So I've had 5 years now exploring the museum full time, but I've been working on the Design Museum for probably close to 10 years. If you trace the Design Museum back to its earliest incarnation, it was a magazine in Phoenix, Arizona. The magazine was called Phil Stroke, and essentially it was a really selfish effort. It was me and two of my colleagues, two other undergraduate students at ASU. And we just wanted to talk to our heroes. So we wrote this long list of questions, or 28 questions, and sent them to every designer you can think of. Massimo Vignelli, Wolfgang Feingart, Rick Valicenti, mostly white men because we didn't really know what we were doing at the time. And we heard back from an amazing slew of people. Debbie Millman in New York, Ed Vella in California, and Rick in Chicago, and sort of people across the world. And it was this exciting moment. I got a call from Ed Vella, and we spent 2 hours on the phone talking about these questions. Experimental Jet Set wrote an essay for each question and put it on their website. Sagmeister weighed in. You know, we really kind of talked to a lot of folks. We didn't know how to make a magazine. So we folded the project. We put the information online for free, started a design blog called Phil Stroke, and worked on that for a while. Shortly after we folded the magazine idea, though, we had a real conversation. What does Phoenix need? And quickly realized, talking to our professors and working with one another, that Phoenix has a ton of sprawl. So at the time, there was nothing bringing the designers together. There were design activities happening in Chandler and Mesa and Tempe and Phoenix proper, and all of this sort of divided interest. So we wanted to pull everybody together and have a conversation. So we launched a conference. The conference was called Phoenix Design Week, and I was more of an advisor at this point. And the first year, you know, tickets were cheap. They sold several hundred tickets, pulled the design community together, created this energy, you know, worked with AIGA. It was this really exciting time. I went back to my undergraduate pursuits, started working full time for the university, for the president's office, for the provost, for a variety of places, for different colleges. Through my last year, I was working full time and was a senior. And that's when my mother was diagnosed with cancer. So I had made the decision, you know, if the design week was going well, work was going well, I'd graduated, made the decision that it was time to come home. Right around that time, we were having conversations about design week. And funnily enough, or oddly enough, AIGA National decided to plan their national conference in Phoenix to celebrate and support the grassroots work that we were doing. So that year, we didn't want to plan a conference that would compete with AIGA's national conference. We wanted to do something else externally to show the national and international community what we were capable of. So we ended up planning all sorts of pop-up events around the conference, one of which was the Phoenix Design Museum. I did a lot of work from Chicago on the Phoenix Design Museum branding, wayfinding. I designed one of the exhibitions. I did the website, just a lot of sort of organizational work. And throughout that time, learned a lot about what it meant to pull together another grassroots cultural organization. So came to work at Morningstar full time. The thing that I found in Morningstar, at least at the time, was a thriving, interesting design community and creative community. So during lunch, we would sit and talk about, we'd go to lectures together after work, you know, we would really kind of explore not only the work that we were doing for the company, but also what design could be. And we were designing new typefaces, and it was just a really exciting moment. So through this work, I got connected to some folks in recruiting for the company, started thinking about what it meant to hire new designers, to retain the designers that we have, and launched a lecture series, a film series, and a series of tours across the city that were internal to Morningstar. So we would go see things and then talk about them. We'd invite designers in and have a small roundtable discussion in a conference room. And at some point, I got to the point where I really started to miss the broader community in Chicago. So I pulled a couple of colleagues together. There are six of us from Morningstar. We met in my apartment in Logan Square and had a conversation about what Chicago needs. It was pretty exciting. We spent 3 months really talking about what it is that Chicago needs as a magazine, a newspaper, a blog, a company, you know, a firm. That eventually kind of realized that Chicago needs a design museum. It doesn't have one. So we spent the next 3 months, this is in 2012, building the design museum. That was a really interesting pursuit. It was a lot of work. If you imagine, you know, we decided we needed a store. That means we need merchandise and contracts and a POS system, and that multiplies by we also need exhibitions and curators and volunteers and electricity and walls and everything you need to have a museum. So we built that over about 3 months. My mother passed 24 hours before we opened the doors, which meant that I was not there. I was downstate. Making some pretty tough decisions, being by her side as much as I could, being with my stepdad. And what that meant for the museum was that since I wasn't there to lead it, volunteers sort of flooded in and built the whole thing. And volunteers have been in our DNA since then. So the opening reception was fabulous. It was 11 days after Mom passed, June 11th. We had 1,000 people show up, which was a great party. It was so hot. We had opened all the windows. It was just elbow to elbow. 500 people came throughout the month that we were open. It was a pop-up effort. I was a volunteer. Everybody was a volunteer. Shortly after that, we did a pop-up show on a moving train car. Shortly after that, we did a pop-up show downtown in Block 37 in a 17,000 square foot space, where again, we had to literally install the breakers and the electricity and build walls and do everything. For that show, 3,000 people came to that show over the course of a month, 1,700 to the opening party, and then 1,500 just as general daily traffic. I was still a full-time employee of Morningstars. At that point, I decided that it was time to either double down and build the design museum or give it up because it was too much work. So we launched a Kickstarter campaign. The community contributed $50,000. 25 over the first 29 days of the campaign almost gave me a heart attack. And then 25 in the last 8 hours to meet the goal that we'd set. And I left my job, took a massive pay cut, and doubled my hours and started building this nonprofit organization. I never intended to start a museum. I sort of followed this path until I ran into the museum. And there was also never a moment that I thought, I'm going to be a founder and an executive director and a chair and a bartender and a janitor of a design museum. It was always just sort of, well, that needs to be done. Well, this is interesting. And with time, it became this more formalized entity.
Wow, I had no idea, man. This thing taking shape as you work through it, the different permutations, you know, all the formats and environments in which you kind of piloted the concept. And then maybe the hard pivot is like you said, there was a moment where I needed to leave my job and commit fully to this or abandon the idea. And so maybe it's a combination, you know, this kind of gradual progression to a point where you kind of have a go, no go decision. And obviously, you know, you chose the museum. I think I was part of the very first one. I think I had t-shirts.
You did. Yeah, totally.
In your gift shop. Yep.
I remember that. Yeah.
But I remember thinking, like, how the hell does this guy do this? Like, is this a full-time thing? This seems like a lot of work to not be a full-time thing. But how is he making any money where this could be a full-time? I was just totally curious and puzzled as to how you'd, like, take over a really what felt like a warehouse space and turn it into something so awesome in what felt like your nights and weekends, which is just crazy to me.
No, and it still feels like that, you know, the museum. I mean, one thing the design does is it makes something feel bigger and more established than it is. And we fight with that all the time. We are not established. We're not stable. And, you know, I might regret saying these things too, but we've never missed a payroll. You know, we have 4 employees now. And at the moment we have 4 interns, we've had 45 or 50 throughout the last few years. There's this impression that a museum is a very serious thing. And using that word, I didn't realize when we founded the museum that word would be so influential on the decisions that we made going forward. And, you know, in some ways that's detrimental to have a founder that isn't trained in museology. But there's also a lot of benefit there in that we can start to explore things, can start to figure out how to fund a nonprofit like this, can start to think about what it means to take a museum and put it on a train car or put it on light poles in the loop and work with, you know, third graders to make artwork for that. Like, there's this exploration that I find really exciting. And to tie this back to our previous conversation, a lot of that exploration, I think, is nostalgic for me. It feels like being on the farm outside of Macomb. If you find a pothole, you fill it. You know, you don't call somebody and complain. Like, you get your hands dirty. You don't work with problems. You work with solutions. There's a lot that I learned growing up on the farm or adjacent to the farm, as my brother was actually doing farm work and I was watching him from behind my laptop. But a lot of those qualities certainly carried forward into the work that I'm doing today.
How did you find out you were having a kid?
That's a great question. Let me just say that she's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. I just want to say that and have that recorded. How did I find out? I mean, my wife told me. We were trying. We were ready. So when I first started dating Robin, she was maybe 30, and she told me, hey, I'm getting to the point where I'm ready to have a family, and we need to decide pretty quickly if this is serious. Otherwise, I need to find somebody that's serious. And I had just gotten a divorce maybe a couple years ago. The ink was still fresh and wasn't quite ready to settle down, but was pretty in love and pretty interested in exploring that. So we had a conversation, decided that, you know, this was going to be serious. We were going to give this a shot, and started spending a lot of time together. Fast forward, you know, I proposed, we got married, we went on this big honeymoon, and had decided that this was all part of the plan. We were going to get married and have a kid right away. I can't remember the exact moment, if I'm being entirely honest with you. I think it was pretty casual. Like, I think we were just at home and, you know, she went to the bathroom and took the test and came out and told me, and we celebrated.
So you knew going into the relationship and then obviously your marriage that she wanted to start a family, and you were committed to at least exploring the idea of children and kids. And when did you realize that you were ready to have a kid?
I have always wanted a family. I've always wanted at least one kid. I haven't really put a lot of thought into how many we might have. Kind of just like with the Design Museum, following it and following the relationship and seeing where it leads. As soon as she said that, I felt like suddenly it wasn't her plan anymore. It was our plan. And that's something that we talked about quite a bit is in our early conversations. I asked her how many kids she wanted, and she said, you know, I don't know, because I never imagined that was my decision. I always imagined it was a decision I would make with my partner. And I just really loved that perspective. So the more we talked about it, the more we realized that we saw the world in a very similar way. And in the ways that we didn't see the world, we were very good at compromising and giving space. Again, I don't think there was a moment that I was like, I'm ready for a family, I'm going to have a kid. I think it was another evolutionary, slow process.
And how would you characterize the emotions? You said she came out, she told you, you celebrated. But from that point, 9 months of being in wait.
Right. Purgatory.
Yeah. can you recall emotions or moments between the celebratory we're pregnant to the day that your daughter was born?
I think there are two main categories. There's love or excitement and fear. And the love and the excitement was consistent, and the fear sort of came in waves and tampered or lessened pretty quickly after Emmy was born. So I think the love and the excitement, like I said, was consistent. There was a lot of celebrating. One specific moment I can remember is I spent all day Christmas Day putting her room together, and it was such an amazing, warm, nostalgic feeling. The fear side was less about, you know, is she going to be okay? Is she going to have health issues? Like, those things were running through my mind. I think Robin was more worried about those things than I was, to be honest. I was really worried about how we were going to sustain the family. I'm not the breadwinner. I put in a lot of hours and a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of stress. And I try not to bring that stress home, but I certainly do. I'm human, but really worried about, you know, what happens when the museum runs out of money, and what does that mean for my family? What happens when we get sued? And, you know, we've never been sued. We've never run out of money, but those sort of very real fears and thoughts were pretty constant. I was also, you know, going through therapy pretty regularly through the entire process. I was changing medications and trying to rebalance chemicals to deal with some of these anxieties that I had.
The unknown impact of a kid on work or on your practice or whatever it is, like for me, it felt so big that I couldn't even come around to the idea of having a kid for a while. Like Maris and I started to pursue couples therapy just to address that one issue. To adjust like my total freak out and just like anti-kid resolve. And so I think this kind of contemplation you're describing, I think there's some people that can't ever get out of it. They just sort of stay in that mode of like all the what ifs or all the unknowns are worse than whatever joy they might anticipate from having a kid, or, you know, any positive feelings associated with having a kid or becoming a parent. And how did you ultimately work through it or think through what impact is this going to have on my career and my work and what I've been doing all the way up until now?
So I'm the type of person that lives about 18 hours in the future. I don't plan weeks or months out. I mean, I do have certain things, like we plan exhibitions at the museum, I plan vacations, that kind of thing. And I look forward to these things. But for the most part, when I'm dealing with my calendar, I look at today and tomorrow effectively. And I also make big decisions and then I'm comfortable reneging on those decisions when needed. So, you know, we decided that we were going to have a kid. I didn't worry a whole lot because it wasn't in the immediate future. It was more thinking about, you know, what kinds of things do I want to do before we have the kid, like travel the world and that kind of thing. So a lot of these fears and anxieties for me came after we were pregnant, before she was born. Really in that 9 month period is where I think I dealt with and grappled a lot of this. It was not for me ever like, no, we can't have a kid, or no, I'm nervous about the fact that about having a kid until this happens or we meet these goals that we've set. It was more, okay, now we're pregnant. holy shit, I've got 9 months to get my life together, or I've got 9 months to figure out where funding is going to come next year so they can be stable. And then pretty much the day she was born, all of that washed away. Somehow you find the 20 grand a year or whatever you need for daycare. Somewhere you find the 20 hours a week or whatever it is that you need to sit on the floor and play with blocks, or hold her hand as she tries to walk for the first time, or whatever it might be. I used to bring work home every single day, and I would work for a few hours in the evening, and now I just don't. And the museum, I think it does suffer a little bit for it, and we're trying to figure out how to fill that void, but it doesn't suffer so much that it shuts down. And at some point, you know, life just pushes you in a direction, and I found that if you're just willing and accepting, then, and figuring out how to deal with that in the moment, that there's a lot less stress. I mean, there's, the stress is different, maybe more intense, and maybe in certain waves, but there was never really a big conversation about, are we going to do this? It was more how and when, and then it just kind of happens and you deal with it.
No big deal.
No big deal. It's just a life. You know, it's just a human being that fully relies on every single moment of you.
I know, right? Damn it.
No big deal.
So things like work bleeding into home life and being intentional about curbing that, or just, you know, carving out time that is now dedicated to other things, namely your daughter. What other parts of your creative practice, or kind of running the museum, what other things can you point to that have evolved or adapted since your daughter being born?
There are two answers I want to give you to this. One is that we have intentionally tried to not change our lives too much, but simply to involve Emmy in our lives more often. 11 months old, and she's already been to a political rally, to several design lectures, to art openings, all sorts of creative exercises. Just this week, I gave a short 15-minute talk at the U.S. Pizza Museum and brought her along with me because Robin was in Atlanta. And I'm so grateful to my friends, Paul and Libby, who showed up and babysat her while I was on stage and just let her crawl around and be a kid and explore things. And that is very important to me in the way that I parent, because I think it's going to expose her to the world in ways that a lot of other kids don't get to be exposed. And not to say that it's better than what other parents do, it's just different. It's an opportunity that I have, so I want to use it. The other thing I want to say is that through this process of being a dad and learning how to be a dad, I have just found so much creative energy. So I've put a lot of that into the design museum, mostly in trying to find ways to stabilize things here so that I can have a life outside of this place, but also in terms of painting, like I mentioned, and creative projects. So there are two things that I've started doing in terms of creative projects. One is painting murals. So over the past 10 months, I've painted probably 7, maybe 8 murals all across Chicago. Some are already gone. They're very temporary, and some will be up for a very long time. They're all typographic. They're all relatively simple, and based on context. So I think about the place that I'm going and try to do a mural that can only be done in that place. I've got several lined up, and I tend to, again, try to involve Emmy in that. I mean, part of that is having an escape, but also part of that is, when appropriate, trying to engage Emmy in it. For every mural I paint, I make a companion piece for it on canvas that I keep at home, and eventually it'll be a show, or who knows, maybe I'll burn them in a big bonfire. But some of those I've involved Emmy in. So I'll set her on my lap and I'll grab some painter's tape and start masking off an area, and I'll hand her a piece of tape and she'll play with the stickiness for a while and then take it and like wave it over her head as fast as she can for a while. And then I'll get out the paintbrush and I'll put a little speck of paint on the back of her hand while I'm painting, and she'll play with it with her finger and try to figure out what I'm doing. And I found that the paintings that we make together, she is obsessed with. So when I walk down the hallway, she'll crane her neck to see it, and we'll stop and look at it, and we'll talk about it. And I started an art collection in her room, and she's got an amazing art collection already. I've got original art, Paul, like Matthew Hoffman, like whatever. I put one up, I always like tap on it and show it to her, make sure she knows that we're putting it up together, and she gets really excited. It's super cute. I've also got a new series that I'm working on called Cutting Room Floor that takes all of the disused vinyl waste from the design museum. So normally you throw all that away, but I'm saving all of that material because it's really beautiful material and turning it into collages and artwork. And I have made in the last 10 months, I counted the other day, somewhere around 250 pieces of art at various sizes from 3 foot by 5 foot down to 8 by 10. I also involve Emmy in that in some ways. And occasionally it'll be like, you know, I'm peeling a sticker off a piece of paper and then I'll hand her the piece of paper and she'll just kind of giggle and watch me and play with it and just kind of get involved, you know, in some way. I don't know if you found any of that energy after your kid was born. Just opened this whole new door for me. And I've really kind of enjoyed exploring all of that.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think there's a bunch of cool bits tied into that. Like even just the choice to recycle material, saying, and in a small way, I'm leaving the planet a little bit better for Emmy, right? By not putting this into a waste stream. And, you know, you hear that all the time that, you know, oh, you can see the world through fresh eyes. Or, you know, you'll take on your child's perspective and see things in new ways you never thought of, or in ways that you forgot about because you're an adult and you feel like you've seen everything. And so I think as like sappy as that sounds, it's quite profound to bear witness to someone doing or seeing something for the very first time. That's a cool thing to see and internalize and process. And I think as Javier's discovered the world and now Amaya is coming into awareness herself at about 9 months, it's just a nice reminder to slow down and see things, to notice things. Like Javier talks about being a good noticer.
That's awesome.
Yeah, which I think is just a really beautiful way to describe paying attention to details. Like you said, hanging up artwork in your daughter's room, nothing gets past him. You know, like the smallest tweak to something, like, you know, we might position furniture a little bit differently or swap one piece of art out for another or something really mundane. Like instead of hanging his coat on the hook, we put it on a hanger and he'll stop and comment on like the most mundane changes to his tiny world because he just, I don't know, he's got more room on his hard drive and he notices things, you know. And I don't know that that's necessarily impacted my creativity, but I think being a good noticer is a significant input to making work. And of course, there's the very tangible examples of this, like him climbing into my lap and us having a lot of fun at the Wacom tablet and exploring mediums like crayons that I haven't played with in a long time. And to just kind of nerd out and play like that, I think it is joyful and it is a reversal of all the other feelings that I have often around making things, like knowing the latest piece of software or being familiar with the ins and outs of, you know, some new digital tool. And maybe that's all just sort of a distraction from the act of making. And so playing with rudimentary sorts of things helps reset that for me.
I think that's the key word, play. It does feel like I didn't give myself time to play a year ago. And now that Emmy's here and we are playing constantly every single day, it kind of turned on this other part of my brain that made me want to play a bit more professionally, a bit more grown up. And I think that's where a lot of this work came from.
I should say that I often take on projects now because I think they might be helpful to other people or to my own kind of career. But there's also like this, and it sounds so shitty, but there's this like this other criteria of like, and can I make a little extra scratch? Because that wouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
Especially now that I'm taking a year off of work.
Right.
So how...
Congratulations, by the way. I don't think I said that yet.
Oh, I appreciate that very
much. That's huge.
How much are some of these new things, if at all, driven by revenue?
Yeah, there are two types of projects. And I don't take on any projects unless I think I'm going to enjoy them if they're outside of the museum, because they do distract me from my family in some ways. So I take on some projects that don't pay anything and bring me a lot of joy. And then I take on some projects that pay and that maybe bring less joy. That's not always the case. Sometimes, you know, there are projects that pay and bring a lot of joy, and those are ideal. But yeah, we're trying to fill out that 401k a bit. I'm not paid nearly what I was at Morningstar. Still, at the Design Museum, we're still kind of scraping by and figuring things out. And we don't have a 401k match. We don't have a program for those sorts of things. And we'll build to that, and we'll get there in the next few years as we scale more. But in the interim, I am trying to do as much paid external work as I can, and have found that my introverted qualities have really started to flourish over the past year or two.
say more.
Yeah. So I do think that I'm perceived as being an extrovert, you know, running the design museum and being the chair and the ED and the bartender. I find myself constantly in places where I'm expected to be vocal, friendly, getting people on board, finding new volunteers, talking about all these exciting things that we've done over the past 7 or 8 years. But on the other side, or on the inside, I just want to go home, be with my family, and chill out and not be on and make things that fulfill me. So the extracurricular paid work that sort of fills out the 401k has a criteria for me where it has to be enjoyable, or it's not worth doing. And Robin has been my manager over the past 9 months. So we set her up an email address. When I find clients and work, I filter them through her, partially because it's not the part of the work that I enjoy, and she does enjoy it quite a bit, but also partially because I tend to do a whole lot of free work. I found a lot that my career has been pretty dependent on the generosity of a lot of people, and I'm really grateful for that. So I find myself wanting to give back a lot, and she's really good at saying, you know, maybe this isn't the project to give back on, or maybe this is the project to give back on. It actually just happened with a project that I can't talk about yet, but I'm super excited. It doesn't pay, but it's going to be really wonderful. And she's been really good at sort of helping me manage the flow and the expectations around the work that ultimately takes time away from her and the kid.
That's awesome. And I know that Robin is involved in design, and that is also her career. So how does she squeeze in being your manager?
Barely. I think she enjoys it, to be honest with you. And I think it's sort of, she's a very organized person. She's a planner. We're very different in a lot of ways, and very similar in a lot of ways as well. And I think she really enjoys talking to people, representing an artist, being able to, you know, often even with projects, I involve her at every single step. I'm ultimately trying to make something that impresses her, and then it generally impresses other folks as well. So she enjoys negotiating and being on the phone and giving me material suggestions and design suggestions and different things like that. We set up a Slack channel for the family, and
that's awesome. Is this just the two of you in that Slack channel?
It is, yeah.
That is a very tight Slack.
Yeah. And there are like, so I forgot what it's called, but like a Slack company or whatever. And then we have like a dozen channels. We have project-based channels. We have a channel that's just called Love. And when you go there, you just have to feel good when you leave. Like, you know, it was her idea. I'm not organized, but man, has it made communication between us better and more focused.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I think she needs to write a Medium post about like the Slack hack for family life and for for home communication. It's brilliant. I think it's when you first said it, I was like, I don't understand. And then like 2 seconds in, I'm like, I think I need a Slack channel.
Yeah.
and sticking with this, the topic of the two of you and how you complement each other, you mentioned a traditional role or an identity as breadwinner or provider. And we've talked prior to this about some of these definitions and about some of these roles, and they tend to be, in many cases, gender specific. What you and Robin are doing, and even just your pursuit before Robin to let the museum take over as your full-time commitment, you're changing definitions around that, or at least, you know, kind of norms. Could you speak a little bit to those dynamics and how you balance that or work through that with Robin?
Yeah, for sure. So there are a lot of ways that we're non-traditional, and there are a lot of ways that we are traditional. I think that the way that we manage it, and we're, this is, there's ebbs and flows here. We're never really fully on, is by communicating a a lot. We've tried different things. Certain things have worked really well and they've kind of faded away. And one of those things is at the end of the day, every single day we used to have a conversation that started with a question. And the question was always, what are you most proud of today? We'd sit down and we'd talk about that. Ultimately that would lead to other things. We talk about anxieties and fears and those sorts of things. And then you just get too busy to continue that trend. We try to find a lot of space for one another as well. So every now and then I'll take off for a night and go stay at Longman and Eagle and she'll stay home with the kid and I'll get a good night's sleep and I'll relax or watch TV or whatever it is that I want to do when I don't have any commitments. And then 2 months later, she'll go to the Soho House and get a massage and have a nice cocktail and spend the night. And I found that when I get burnt out, it's because I'm feeling very exposed because I've been forced to be in very extroverted positions for too long and need to just go stay in bed somewhere and not talk to anybody to sort of recoup and fill back up my passion that I need to find in my work. And she's found very similar things. So I'm pretty far off from your question, but there are all sorts of kind of different methods that we've found to manage this much more complex situation that we've found ourselves in. And some of them are, you know, gender specific, and we talk about that, and some of them are not. It sort of also to me feels like that just because things are a certain way now, life changes quick and you're not in control of it. So I could very much be the breadwinner in 6 months. I think she desires to be a stay-at-home mom. I know she does, actually, but I don't know when that's possible. It's something that we're working toward and we're thinking about and constantly kind of working on. But at the end of the day, you know, there's lots of ways to solve that problem. One is that I find another source of income and allow her to have the time. The other is that, you know, the time that she does have maybe shouldn't be spent grocery shopping, and we can order in and spend a few extra bucks on delivery, but give her 2 hours more with Emmy. And, you know, so we have a lot of those conversations in the moment, and things kind of shift and change as needed.
I love the intentionality of some of those practices, even if they're not sustained over periods of time, or, you know, you do something for a while and you get what you need out of it. And then the calendar takes over and you find a new way to connect or a new way to disconnect. Like the intentional choice to leave the house for a night individually or on your own, I think is an amazing thing for people to explore. You know, there's the, hey, I'm going to go grab brunch with my girlfriends, or like, hey, I'm going to meet up with a couple of guys for dinner or something like that. But the actual spending the night somewhere else is I don't know anybody else that does that. I think that's so simple, but I could see how that would be like rejuvenating. I like these more specific tactical strategies for protecting time or preserving time. And I think it's encouraging for me to hear how creative you can be with it or how experimental you can be with it. And clearly there's other ways of doing it and other environments to do it in, and times of day or extended periods of time. Like it still feels like a more creative approach to trying to like refuel.
Yeah, it's actually also incredibly hard to do. It sounds easy and luxurious, but in the even leading up to it, you know, Robin and I had a couple of conversations where I felt really guilty for putting that on her and giving, and, you know, she was excited. She went and saw her parents and it was going to be extra work, but she was kind of looking forward to having some one-on-one time with Emmy and all of that. But the way that we this time got around the guilt was her saying, you know, this is your time and I'm going to take time soon and I'll need you to help me with that. And I was like, okay, you know, that's cool. I can feel comfortable getting away knowing that I'll pay you back at some point, and that also that we're sort of always even. She's done this before too. It's hard and so rewarding. And the more space that you can give yourself, I found the more you're able to recoup. So really drawing hard lines of this time, I really didn't tell that many people I was doing this aside from my colleagues. I just kind of escaped and was alone.
You know, you're talking about how you've involved Emmy in different creative endeavors, large and small, and taking her to lectures and just this exposure, I think is amazing and something that a lot of children don't get ever in their life, you know, even within school. And so she's lucky. There's an intentionality about your own child's creativity. Or what if Emmy ends up crazy about math or science or like loves, you know, sports, and she's just super physical and she's like, Daddy, I'm gonna be a kickboxer. I don't care about art and design and craft and creativity.
She can be whatever the fuck she wants. She can be a stripper. I don't care. As long as she's making money and she's happy, and she's healthy. I mean, clearly I'd have a conversation with her and steer her away from it, but accountant, Republican, whatever she wants, I don't care. I'll support her.
Nice.
Because I know she's going to be making these decisions very intentionally. I know she'll be involving them in us in them, rather.
And then it's also just, it's just her own wiring, you know, and that unpredictable X factor that with all the conditioning and exposure and opportunity and whatever it is that we do, they still do their own thing. And I think that's awesome. And it's also kind of scary because it's a piece of them that you don't have input on and you can't control. And you hope that whatever percentage of the pie chart that is them, that they own fully, you hope that that's like the best it can be, right? Because there's going to be some that's just out of control. And
And we'll deal with it.
Yeah, I love it. And it also makes me nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, she's going to fuck up, you know, and we all do. And we'll just deal with it. The best we can do is give her guiding principles that make her make good decisions. But, she, you know, she's going to push her boundaries. And that's part of life. You mentioned earlier that, you know, kids are experiencing everything for the first time. And that's something that I found to be extremely true. Like if she's falls over and bonks her head and cries the loudest I've ever heard, it's because that's the most painful thing she's ever felt. Like she's going to be okay.
But that's right.
Like that's the most painful thing that's ever happened in her entire life. It's like, of course she's going to cry, you know, and the same thing when we were running, like she was kind of falling and tripping, and but man, she was laughing so loud. It was like the most fun she's ever had. And to be able to experience that every single day and to be able to experience her, she's the more obsessed with books than I've ever been. And that I shouldn't speak for Robin. I think she's also a lifelong learner, but at least Robin reads to her every single day. I read to her most days, but she gets 5 to 10 books down a day. And she smiles and you pick them up and she's excited and she helps turn the pages. And I think that part of it is the exposure. And I think part of it is the just the environment that we create with her. Part of it is, you know, Robin's actually much better at this than I am. Last night, Robin was putting her to bed and Emmy decided she wasn't tired yet. So she crawled off her lap and went over to her clothing bin and started pulling out every single outfit individually and putting it on the ground. And I wouldn't let her do that. You know, I'd stop her from doing that. But Robin took this amazing video and sent it to me and was like just teasing her, like, is that where the clothes go? She put the clothes there. And Abby was looking back and smiling and just having a great time. And there's this like freedom that Robin's found that she can give her that I'm still like, I still have that protective bone somewhere in me that I try very hard to ignore.
Do you have any resources or go-tos or, you know, when you're faced with things as a new dad, like we said, there's so much stuff that she's experienced for the very first time. And same for the two of you. You as a dad. Like you've never done this, so you're only as good a dad as you are today. It's not like you've had a prior experience. And so anything that you like or that you call upon in your time of need as a dad?
We talk to our parents a lot and solicit a lot of advice from them. They mostly just want to see pictures of the kid, which is healthy and exciting. We talk through things quite a bit. Robin does a lot of research, which I appreciate very much. And we also have a lot of friends that have kids, and we'll text them sometimes and deal with things. But so far, we really haven't been presented with any major challenges that have really tested our mettle on this, but it's coming.
Well, maybe my hope is that the show can be that for some people. I make no claims that this is scientifically proven advice, But I think the softer side of that, the feelings side of that, the pulling back the curtain on how people work and think about their creative endeavors and their kids and reconciling the two of those. I would love for someone to hear this and go, oh, yeah, I was thinking about starting a crazy nonprofit thing. And it seems like a really bad idea because I've got this full-time job and it, you know, it's consistent and secure. And like, I don't know if I can take the risk. And for someone to say, oh, yeah, that's what Tanner did. And he didn't end up on the street, you know, and he just had a kid and like he's still managing to pull that off like that. That's awesome. Like, at least that's what this conversation is doing for me.
Yeah, I feel similarly. I think the context and the perspective is really helpful, and understanding, you know, we're all going through this for the first time, even if it's our second kid, you know, it's the first time you've had two kids and you've had to figure out how to guide them together and treat them as individuals and all of that. I did have just a little bit of experience raising my sister. She was 10 years younger than I was. Mm-hmm. And I was around quite a bit for a lot of the hard conversations, the big decisions, and, you know, gave her baths and changed her diaper and all of that. So there was a little, I draw on that a lot. In fact, the first couple of months of Emmy's life, every time I looked at her, I thought about my little sister. And it took me a long time to start seeing her as her own person, which I do. Now she's got enough of a personality that she's certainly her own person. But that's, I mean, that's not necessarily, it's a little bit of life experience, but it doesn't necessarily help with some of the specific issues that we have to deal with.
Yeah.
But I think that this podcast as a resource, or at least this podcast as exposure to other ideas and ways of thinking is really exciting.
Nice. What advice do you have for the creative guy who's about to become a dad? Maybe who everyone is telling your life is over. We talked about that
advice,
right? Yeah. We talked about that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like what would you tell? What would you tell a colleague now that you've had some experience in doing this? Like, hey Tanner, my wife and I were pregnant. This happened.
It's going to be okay. I think that's all I can say. Everything you're worried about is not going to matter. You're going to find the money. You're going to find the time, find the energy, the people that you think you're never going to see again, you are still going to see, and it's going to be okay.
Yeah. Where were you? Where were you, Tanner, when I needed you?
Yeah. Where was I when I needed myself? It just comes with experience, you know?
Yeah. You've mentioned more than once these things that we hold as vital and think are our truth, or the definition of creative success, or whatever it is that we have as ideals related to career, especially when we're trying to do something that's not a popular path, and how much of that melts away. I mean, for me, it was the day that Javier was born, and right up to it, I'm still sweating the issues. I'm still really concerned. I'm still, you know, all of that is still in there, like up until we're at the hospital, and then I'm holding him, and I'm just sobbing. I'm sobbing like ugly crying. Mm-hmm. And Maris is like, tell me how you feel, or, you know, how are you feeling? And it was just this moment where all of that stuff leading up to it fell away, like just washed away. And I think I said this out loud to her, like, how stupid that I was worried about this, this, and this. Nothing else matters now. Like, they all came rushing back. Like,
yeah, right.
You know, once you're home and you're settling into a groove and you're sort of over the intensity of this crazy thing, like, they're all there waiting for you. But in that moment, it was hilarious to me that, like, I was worried about the things that I was worried.
Yeah, it's really something. I'm sitting here thinking about what I was doing the moment that Emmy was born, and her birth felt so fast. The actual process was about 15 minutes. I mean, there are several hours leading up to it, clearly, and several days following it. But the actual giving birth was about 15 minutes. And after the fact, you know, I held Emmy for the first time, and Robin, you know, had to go through all sorts of things that I don't think I could ever go through. She's so much strength. We went to the room, and we spent the night with her, and woke up the next morning and spent the day with her. And I mean, it all is really blurry because you're feeding her every couple hours, and you're changing diapers and checking on her and making sure she's still breathing and all the things that you do as a new dad. And there was a moment where I was like, I just need to get out of this room for a minute. So I went to the car and then came back into the room and felt more love than I think I've ever felt in my life. Like, it hit me when I walked into the room that something magical happened in this place and that we're responsible for this life at this point. Sat down and held the baby and talked to Robin. And that's the moment that I think everything changed for me. Everything felt so fast and so out of control and so interesting. And there was so much to think about, but really like escaping from it, which escape seems to be a common theme this morning, but escaping from that, going for a walk around the block, putting my head in a different place, and then walking back into the room was something. And then the next day we put her in the car and drove home, and I'll never forget, it felt like we had $1 billion in the back seat. I was so nervous. like when we left, I actually asked the nurse, like, I can just take her, like, we can just leave with her. She was like, yeah, it's your baby. put her in the back seat, and I drove so slow the entire way home, and then got home and put her in bed. She met the cats. They were in love with her immediately and wouldn't leave her alone, and it was very special.
Yeah, that precious cargo ride home, right, is something, man. I can recall our own, and you keep checking the rearview mirror like, oh my god, this is
yeah, right,
we're on our own now, this is it, like, we're not in the hospital anymore, like, it is on the two of us to keep this human alive. Is a really bizarre feeling.
How was it the second time?
That trip home, and just like,
yeah,
on the ride home, it was still exciting, and it was still like you had $1 billion in the back seat. I just felt so much more in control and so much more confident. And I wasn't driving, you know, 5 miles under the speed limit. I was driving the speed limit, you know, and
yeah.
And when we brought her home, it was different. Like, when we came home with Javier, it was just us. And this time, my folks were in town, and Javier was there waiting. It was just different. It was different to bring the baby into this unit and all this love at once, in the way that when we brought Javier home, we were both sort of like, lock the doors, close all the blinds. Let's just like,
yeah, exactly.
Like, holy shit, what are we doing? It was just amazing in different ways, I think.
When's number three?
Never.
Perfect.
Yeah, science and surgery has already solved that problem for me.
Fantastic.
Yeah, we're good. We're good with two. I'm very okay with that.
Cool.
Yeah, but we're almost at time, man. I want to be respectful in 2 hours of anybody's day, especially someone who's running an operation like yours is a big deal, and I'm so grateful for the chance to chat and for your openness. It's unexpected and kind of beautiful. And I really appreciate it.
This has been really, really wonderful. And I tend to do a lot of talking like this, and it's about usually the design museum or practice or getting away, and less with the threat of family through it. And that's the thing that I'm the most excited about in my life. So the 2 hours have been incredibly fast. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell Podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a quick review on iTunes. As a first season podcast, this helps a ton, and it would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks, so visit dadwell.co to find links to all of them. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter and even cop some fresh Dadwell merch. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks again for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.